New Year's, and we are happy celebrating, but at the same time we are praying for Tripoli and for
because Tripoli is our country, yesterday, today, and tomorrow.
We are calling for the unity of the
because Tripoli is our country, yesterday, today, and tomorrow.
We are calling for the unity of Libya. The capital city is Tripoli.
How is the coalition, the Itilaf, supporting Tripoli? What are you doing to support people in Tripoli
now,
and Zawiya?
Now there's a meeting outside the court here with people from coalition from Tobruk, Beva, and Derna. Okay, and now they're having a meeting now, and they are discussing these things, and we will see they will decide about.
We cannot talk so much into the future. We are just living it minute by minute, and this is overwhelming even to the people, the international media, the international community. This is something never happened in history, and we are doing, and we are surprised ourselves, and we are proud, because in Benghazi there is no looting, there is no chaos. Everything is, every person in this country and this city has been participating and protecting private and public property. Everybody is opening his home for the expatriates. We are doing everything. There might be minor mistakes, but this is normal. We are in emergency, but we are doing great.
And I want to say something else, that everybody from outside, they are asking us, what you want to do? Please be patient. Please. You know, there's a lot of stress on us, okay? Because we didn't plan it in Egypt. When they said that they prepared since 2005 for 5 years, we didn't do nothing, okay? It's like this.
It's the will of God.
Yeah.
In this situation, what is it you'd like from the international community? Is there something that you'd like to see? Some what kind of tangible support would you like from the governments and from the people?
Mm-hmm. We need their support, and we thanks all the media who comes here so they can see by their own eyes that we didn't lie.
Yeah, very urgent demands, and that's what we want from the international world, is a non-flight zone in Libya, because this is the only way they can help us. If the Security Council and the United Nations, they have that, they are helping us a lot, because this is the only way we can help liberating Tripoli, then everybody can come and help and comes out.
That was Hannah Al-Ghalal and Salwa Bougegis, lawyers in Benghazi, members of the Coalition for the Revolution, interviewed by Democracy Now!'s Anjali Kamat. In our last minute now, we turn to Sarah Leah Whitson, Executive Director of the Middle East and North Africa Division at Human Rights Watch, just returned from the Libya-Tunisia border, where thousands of people are fleeing the unrest in Libya. In this last minute, Sarah, if you could tell us what you are witnessing.
The border has been flooded with foreign migrant workers leaving Libya, overwhelmingly Tunisian and Egyptian workers. There have been about 40,000 who have left the western border of Libya, and the Egyptians, who were about 20,000 of those, have been by and large stranded because the Egyptian government has not been able to prepare the evacuation of their nationals from Tunisia, and they've been there for several days in tents, in very cold, rainy weather, and increasingly frustrated and upset at being stuck after a very stressful journey through Libya.
The numbers, Sarah Leah Whitson, that Human Rights Watch now believes the number of people who have been killed and injured in Libya.
We don't have a formally updated figure since the 300 we gave several days ago, and that's primarily because our ability to contact hospitals parts of the country not under the control of protesters dramatically shrank in the middle of this week when the government stopped the use of telephones and internet access. But I would comfortably, confidently say that it is at least double our initial estimate of 300 by now.
Sarah Leah Whitson, thank you for joining us, Executive Director of the Middle East and North Africa Division at Human Rights Watch. Just returned from the Libya-Tunisia border. That does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
The C.J. Monfort Center is a resource center for people of color and Aboriginal peoples at the University of Guelph. This is where we all unite. The Monfort Center, located in McKinnon Room 54 and 55, provides a microwave, two computers, and a fridge, among other resources. The center is a place to study, sleep, or relax. It's a place for great conversation. If you want to vent, share experience, good or bad, this is the place for you. You meet great people, and it's just an overall awesome environment. Don't hesitate to drop in anytime before 10 p.m. and you're sure to meet a smiling face. For more information, call us at 519-824-4120, extension 56911, or visit us at www.uoguelph.ca/Monfort or join our Facebook group.
This is Tasha T, and you don't know anytime I'm in Guelph, I always tune into Nikki Dread and the Crooked Beat. Oh, you mean, man? On CFRU 93.3 FM every Thursday from 7 to 9 p.m. You don't know. We're gonna rectify the problem. Let's live and learn to solve them. We're gonna make it work together for the children. Oh, you mean, man? 25 years of reggae revolution. Set it!
Welcome to Terra Informa, your source for radio environmental news. I'm Alex Hindle, and I'll be your host on this audio adventure. On today's show, we'll be learning about the future of Canadian energy, the quandaries of fossil classification, and how the city of Yellowknife is turning an old mine into a source of clean geothermal energy. But before the main course, let's whet our appetites with this week's review of the environmental news from across Canada and the world. Here's Jason with the headlines.
First, we go to Ontario, where it has been recently discovered that the Ontario Ministry of Transport sprayed Agent Orange along provincial highways during the 1980s. Archive documents also confirmed that forestry workers were exposed to the toxic herbicide while helping to clear massive plots of crown land in northern Ontario in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Agent Orange is the defoliant most well known for its use in the Vietnam War and has been linked to birth defects and deadly illness. Gilles Bizon, a provincial New Democrat, says former officials with the Ontario Ministry of Transportation have told him that employees involved in spraying the substance wore no personal protection.
We learned last week through the Toronto Star that a number of people, and I would say in the thousands of people, were affected by Agent Orange that was dispersed by companies under direction from the Ministry of Natural Resources. How could it be in a modern democracy like ours that the public was not informed when it was found out that this Agent Orange led to the cause of cancer?
Now to BC, where RCMP have discovered 34 cesspools related to pot production in the BC interior. These pools of toxic material are a concoction of pesticides, herbicides, fertilizers, and diesel fuel. These waste sites are often located near streams and wetlands. MLA Bob Simpson is concerned that the toxic cesspools could contaminate soil, streams, and aquifers, resulting in long-term environmental damages. Brown says the RCMP are not trained or funded to clean up these chemical dumps, and no one in BC is legally responsible for cleaning up these chemical ponds. He hopes the Environment Ministry will step in. In Alberta, the heavily promoted carbon capture and storage initiatives for the oil sands have been put on hold. Although the government lists managing energy resources responsibly as a top priority, the recent budget put forward a 3.3% decrease in funding for Alberta Environment Department, which resulted in halting the initiative. In response to criticisms, Environment Minister Rob Renner stated that it's all about focusing on the outputs rather than inputs, pointing to the $3 million added to environmental monitoring, claiming that this new cash will pay for an expert panel to work on recommendations to create a better environmental monitoring system for the oil sands. The money will also help the actual revamp of the program after the panel submits a report in June. The Alberta government's commitment to fund $2 billion in CCS projects by 2020 is the foundation of its strategy to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Although the province's total greenhouse gases are projected to grow until at least 2020, CCS is supposed to begin the job of cutting emissions within 4 years. The provincial government insists the funding slowdown is not about saving money or wavering in its commitment to greenhouse gas reduction, but simply that federal funding needs to be in place and private players are not yet ready to pursue CCS initiatives.
That was this week's Environmental News. Energy seems to be Canada's biggest line of business these days. Oil, gas, coal, uranium, if you can burn it, we've got it. The Prime Minister, in particular, is enthusiastic about what further development of our energy resources will do for our economy. But how will this fit in with our carbon reduction goals? And is it really that good for the economy anyhow? Today, correspondent David Cochin takes an in-depth look at Canada's energy future. He starts his report with some words from Prime Minister Stephen Harper.
Canada, as you know, is in a remarkable position, is that we are maybe the only country in the world that literally has a surplus of virtually every form of energy. Mm-hmm. Energy security is not an issue in this country. So whatever the energy mix of the future is, Canada is going to be a major player in the energy business. That's why I say we're an emerging energy superpower.
That's the Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, talking about why he calls Canada an emerging energy superpower. It's a grand statement. It's got energy companies excited, but some people a little nervous at the same time. Where exactly is Canada going in its desire to be an energy superpower? And what are the implications for climate change and the future of our economy? Today, we're speaking to two people who spend a lot of time thinking about this. First up is the Pembina Institute's policy researcher, Tim Wise. Given how excited our federal politicians are about the future of energy in this country, I asked him if we had an explicit energy policy.
The short answer is no. At a federal level, well, we don't even have an energy ministry or a department, and so no, we don't have a coherent policy on energy. The resources are controlled at a provincial level, and so we have a fragmented decision-making process around energy, but we're getting to the point more and more across the country where companies and individuals and communities are realizing that we need to start thinking about where we're going with energy in the long term.
Our second guest is Dr. Elwell Bukas, economist and emeritus professor at King's University College in Edmonton. I put the same question to him. Do we have an energy policy for starters?
Well, there are certain marginal measures that the Canadian government has in place, and it has made some commitments of sorts at international meetings and so on. But in terms of an overall energy policy that's at all comparable to that of other countries like those in Europe or even in places like China, Canada really does not have a comparable energy policy.
Energy is an international business, and so is climate change. Given that the federal government is often talking about our international competitiveness, harmonisation with the United States, etc., I asked Elwell Bukas what other countries are doing that we aren't.
Other countries have specific targets, particularly relating to issues like reducing fossil fuel use in energy provision and so on, which we don't have at all.
It's a fast-moving field. I asked Tim Wise for his take on the international scene.
As a policy researcher, you probably look at the policies that lots of other countries have. Who is out in front? Who is perhaps the surprise performer when it comes to transforming their economy from a fossil carbon-based economy to one of green potential and promise?
I think the big surprise has been China in the last 3 years even. And the one important point about renewable energy is it's changing so fast and so quickly that information from 10 years ago is ancient history. Information from 5 years ago is out of date even. And so when you're following this industry, you really got to be keeping up and seeing where things are going, because if information you have is even a few years old, it gets out of date really, really fast. And to that point, China wasn't even in the game 5 years ago. China is really taking this seriously. They obviously have still a heavy dependence on fossil fuels and coal, and they're building all sorts of other stuff. So they're also part of other problems, there's no doubt. But they are really engaging in a very serious way around renewables and around electric cars. And that could be a game changer in terms of the labor force they can mobilize, in terms of the market they have, and in terms of obviously the distribution networks they have across the world. They could really revolutionize where the industry is going.
Probably comes as a surprise to a lot of people, given that China came out of Copenhagen allegedly as something of the villain. Turns out they've actually got a whole lot of initiatives on the go at the same time.
Yeah, they do. I mean, the question of China is very complex one, and I certainly don't mean to distill it down to one issue. But in terms of renewable energy, there is major investments in China, and there's a lot going on. There's no doubt.
You're listening to Terra Informa, and today we're talking about energy policy. The Prime Minister wants us to be an energy superpower. That's his phrase. But as we're hearing from policy experts, we don't really have a plan for being an energy super anything. What's more, we don't have a plan compatible with the need for deep carbon emissions cuts. Not yet, anyhow. So, why the strategy vacuum? Elwell Bukas.
My sense of it is that the way in which the Canadian economy in general has developed has essentially been one in which we produce and export primary products, products like agricultural stuff and now energy and forestry products and so on, without really processing them. And in order to change that, the government, I think, is afraid that this will somehow be very hurtful to our economic situation and the future economic prospect.
Do you think our lack of coordinated national energy policy has anything to do with a legacy from the national energy program from the Trudeau government in the 1980s? Is there any kind of political legacy? Obviously, that was a policy which got some people offside, especially in Western Canada.
It has some relationship to that. The important thing to keep in mind there is that the way in which energy is produced and dealt with in the economy in Canada is a completely provincial issue. In other words, our constitution requires that provinces have the full final say on what happens with energy, and the federal government can only make suggestions and not enforce the way it should go. Seeing that this is constitutionally still in force, the federal government has to tread very lightly in this. But I think the new situation in the world with regard to energy and the energy future and the impact of how we produce and use energy requires that we revisit this. But it's not going to be easy.
It is hard, not least because if you dig a hole somewhere in Western Canada, chances are you'll find something you can burn or sell to the Americans. Many people make their living in the fossil fuel industries, coal mines, the oil sands, gas plants, and they're probably apprehensive about any change. On the other side, change is non-negotiable if we want to play our part in halting climate change. I asked our guests if Western Canada's prosperity really is incompatible with decarbonisation.
I would argue the opposite. You can argue maybe the time frame when renewable energy is going to be coming about, but at the end of the day, we know we're using a finite resource and we're going to need to transition to something that's renewable in the long term. And so at the end of the day, that's the direction that the world is going, and that's the direction that we ultimately have to go. And so the question we need to be asking ourselves is, do we want to be a leader in that, or do we want to be left basically as a post-industrial ghost town or ghost province?
Economist Elwell Bukas concurs.
Unfortunately, the popular opinion in high circles still is that economic development and economic prosperity, in a sense, is in a trade-off situation with the dealing with the sustainability and in an environmental sense. So it is as if we counterpose the economy and the environment. What we should actually see is that the economy is embedded within the environment, and we will have to revisit our understanding of how the economy fits in within the environment. And if we do, and go on to what the implications will be for how we do our things economically, all sorts of new options and opportunities present themselves for what you could vaguely call a green economy. The opportunities are there. It is not as if we have to suffer and come to a standstill economically. Not at all. It's a new kind of economy that we can move into.
So if we need an energy policy, what should it look like?
So you're a policy researcher yourself and policy advocate. If you had to come up with, say, three or four central tenets of what our national energy policy looks like or should look like, what would those central ideas be?
The key one at the end of the day is addressing climate change in the short term, because we know that the most recent science is telling us that we really don't have a whole lot of time to be acting in a really serious way. And so that's, if we're going to be looking at any sort of serious energy policy, it's got to be addressing the impacts of climate change in the very short term. The next issue then, looking at what the long-term sustainability is of our overall energy supply. And ultimately, the big question is, how do we transition from where we are today in a sustainable and a coordinated way to a longer-term, more sustainable strategy? And so I think those are the three things we need to be thinking about. How do we use the resources we have today to make a longer-term transition to somewhere in the future we need to be going?
Today, I've been speaking with the Pembina Institute's Director of Renewable Energy and Efficiency Policy, Tim Wise, and King's University College economist, Dr. Elwell Bukas. Our topic is Canada's energy policy and how it fits in with a world needing to get off carbon. Canada's federal government wants us to be an energy superpower. All well and good, but if this goal is going to sit alongside our climate change obligations, some big policy changes will be needed. For a final word, here's Elwell Bukas once again.
The assumption that the way our economies, and including Canada's, function at the moment has to continue the way it has in the past. And I think that is something that, given the ecological issues of our time, is a very short-term vision and a vision that harks back to what had been before and is not looking forward to what the new situation in the world is.
Thanks, Dave, for that story. You're listening to Terra Informa, your weekly source for environmental news. I'm your host, Alex Hindle. These days, we hear a lot about our carbon footprints. The climate is warming, and if we don't do something to reduce the amount of CO2 we're releasing, well, it's bad news. But that can be easier said than done, especially here in Canada, where a lot of our emissions are from heating our homes and offices. Well, Yellowknife has come up with a pretty innovative solution. City councillors have a plan to cut greenhouse gas emissions for the entire community by converting an abandoned mine near the town into a brand new source of geothermal power. And it's got people talking. When you live as far north as they do, finding a cleaner way to heat your buildings can make a huge difference for the environment and your pocketbook. Here's Steve Anderson with more on that story.
Yellowknife is a city of 20,000, located on the north shore of Great Slave Lake. It got its start back in the 1930s as a gold mining town, and over the years it's evolved to become the largest service hub in the Northwest Territories. As you'd expect, its northern latitude means Yellowknife can get pretty chilly. Temperatures of minus 30 are common in the winter, and record lows have even dipped below minus 50. That's where today's story begins. It's this confluence of frigid winters and a history of gold mining that, oddly enough, have come together to launch a very creative approach to tackling the community's CO2 emissions. Currently, there's no natural gas service in Yellowknife, so most residents rely on heating oil to stay warm.
When we did our community energy plan, we discovered that about 70% of our greenhouse gas emissions come from space heating, and that the vast majority of that is from diesel fuel oil. So it makes a big difference when you can move to other sources of energy for space heating in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
That was Mark Heck, one of Yellowknife City Councillors. For the past several years, the city has been setting the stage for a new district heating system that will make use of geothermal energy tapped from a decommissioned mine near the city. At 2 kilometers deep, the lower regions of the Conn mine can reach temperatures in excess of 35 degrees Celsius.
The way the system would work is that there would be pipes running underground into the mine working, and they would draw from several thousand feet underground, they would draw warm water out of the mine working. It would be brought up to the surface, and heat pump, an electric heat pump, very large industrial size heat pump, would augment the temperature. The temperatures that we've estimated the water to be at underground would not be sufficient to heat a building. You typically need somewhere between 75 and 90 degrees Celsius in order to heat a building in a climate like Yellowknife.
So you pump the water to the surface, and it's quite warm, but it's not hot enough to heat a building. Mayor Gordon Van Tegum explains what happens next.
It's heated further using biomass, or alternatively, it could be using natural gas, it could be using propane, it could be using fuel oil. It all depends on what is the best market decision at the time. It has all those options, so it's heated beyond that, piped through the downtown core of the city initially, and then each of the buildings has a heat exchanger, so you have a hot water in where the water goes into the heat exchanger within the building, circulated through the building, and then you've got a less hot water out. At this point, we're looking at the downtown core, so there's, I believe, 29 significant buildings in that region, and that would be phased in over a period of time once that's all up and we're starting to recover the capital cost.
One of the real benefits of the system is that there's a lot of flexibility. The district heating system acts as a distribution network. It's the series of underground pipes that brings heated water to all of the city's buildings and returns the cool water back to the heating plant. Yellowknife will be doing much of its heating using geothermal energy, but it doesn't really matter how the rest of the heating is accomplished.
One of the advantages of district heating is that it gives you the ability to fuel switch. So, you know, once you have your distribution system set up, then you can mix and match different types of energy sources to meet the demand that you have. So in our case, we're looking at about 50% of the energy coming from geothermal augmented by electric heat pumps, about 45% coming from biomass, wood pellets, and then about 5% from oil, which would act as sort of both a backup and for peak demand.
And in theory, that distribution could be shifted from year to year, allowing the city to make heavy use of a fuel when it's cheap, but reducing the reliance on it at times when it becomes more expensive and instead switching to a different fuel. But the benefits extend beyond just the flexibility of the distribution system.
There's really a lot of benefits to a project like this. Yellowknife is a community, and you know, we're talking about 20,000 people here, so it's not a big city. We spend about $114 million annually on energy. So that's a big economic drain on the community because that money essentially all flows south. So economically, it's an opportunity to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels and to draw from local sources of energy, which kind of keeps the money that's being spent on energy right within the community. It also mitigates the volatility of the price of energy. You know, we've seen in recent weeks how events in far-off places in the world can kind of affect the price of oil at home. So it gives us the ability to reduce that volatility in the prices of energy that Yellowknife residents and businesses experience on a day-to-day basis. It also, you know, the project itself will be a huge injection of money into the local economy just in terms of the construction. We've estimated that the project right now is about a $60 million capital investment, and about half of that would be used on local labor and construction firms and materials. So that'll be a big benefit right there. Socially, we experience a very high cost of living here, and our analysis of the economics of a system like this show that it's not only cost competitive with sort of the business as usual scenario of burning fuel oil, but quite a bit more affordable than that. So it gives us the opportunity to stabilize our cost of living here. And then, of course, environmentally, interesting, it's always sort of the last thing we talk about, but the benefits environmentally are huge as well in terms of improved air quality, reducing greenhouse gas emissions. The estimates that we have right now would probably reduce greenhouse gas emissions by about 17,000 tons per year, which would be the equivalent of taking about half the cars off the road in Yellowknife every year. So that's a major benefit as well.
The project is expected to lower the cost of heating for residents, keep more of the money that they are spending within the community, reduce fluctuations in heating costs, and construction of the project itself will bring money into the community. Plus, it's going to take a huge bite out of Yellowknife's greenhouse gas emissions, as well as improving the city's air quality. If all goes according to plan, it sounds like a project with enormous potential. But there's still a ways to go before everything is finalized.
One of the decisions that still needs to be made is who's going to own it. If the city was to own it, then the benefit goes back to the community. However, like with anything, there's risks, and one of the ways of mitigating risk is to share it. So there are private companies that have approached us that would be looking at sharing that. So now it's a matter of determining how much of a share goes to a private company, how much of it remains with the city.
In addition to money that the private sector may be contributing, the federal government has said that it will provide between $10 and $20 million. But with a lot of details still to be worked out, including the exact amount that will be coming from Ottawa, Yellowknife needs to be sure they have sufficient financing in place. The next big step for the project is a plebiscite on March 14th asking Yellowknife residents for permission to borrow up to $49 million, enough to allow the city to finance the entire project on its own if need be. And if all the pieces fall into place?
Essentially, 2013 would be when construction begins, and probably 2014 the first buildings would hook up to the system, and at 2018 the system would be fully up and running with all buildings connected.
Today we heard from Mayor Gordon Van Tegum and Councillor Mark Heck, who are working on a proposed geothermal heating system for the city of Yellowknife. For Terra Informa News, I'm Steve Anderson. Back to you, Alex.
Thanks, Steve. Next, our Chief Science Investigator, Rebecca Rooney, talks with Lisa Buckley, Curator and Collections Manager at the Peace Region Paleontology Research Centre in Tumbler Ridge, British Columbia, about her PhD research into an important paleontological dilemma.
Today I'm speaking with University of Alberta graduate student and curator and collections manager at the Peace Region Paleontology Research Center in Tumbler Ridge, British Columbia, Lisa Buckley. Lisa, let's start by talking a little bit about your PhD project.
My PhD project is actually looking at modern bird osteology and seeing if you can tell closely related species of modern birds apart just using their bones.